of the conference rooms that were used by the Americans in the embassy, and they would take the reflection of the laser beam, which was modulated by the vibration of the glass in the window, and they would demodulate that reflection and listen to the conversations in the room. I thought that was very clever, and nobody mentioned it. WA2SAY back to Ned.
Haven't heard that story yet, Doug. And where did you get a hold of the story? And do you believe it is accurate that it was really done a whole lot? Because it requires very ideal setting up of the infrared laser transmitter receiver to get that echo off the window with a high enough signal-to-noise ratio that that extremely small amount of vibration of the window, in order to get enough signal-to-noise ratio out of that system, you go through the mathematics of that, and I know somebody who has. I won't say it's impossible, but it is so difficult. The possibility exists that what you heard was a story and might not have been a reality very much of the time. So where did you hear that story from? Do you think it came from an authoritative source, Doug? W2SAY, wait for the beep, K2IW.
Only get one beep here, as I mentioned the other night. I don't know. I heard the story a long time ago, and I suppose that if the Russians were building this embassy, they should have built thin glass into the windows. And if they were right across the street, it wouldn't have been all that difficult, I guess. But I haven't gone through the math, of course.
RY what? Joe recognized. Yeah, the most foolish thing that we ever did in the United States, from one point of view, is to allow the Russians to build the building that became the American embassy. And as I said, every single nail in that building was suspect. I have talked to a human being who spent a significant number of hours, days, months of his life debugging that building. The instrumentation that was required to find the bugs, the methods by which they had to take things apart to get rid of the bugs, the grief that they went through to clean that building, probably cost them more than building the building itself. How in the world we allowed them to build the building was, by current standards, very, very naive. Over to you, Joe. W2LYY, K2IW.
Okay, I let the courtesy tone go. Put in the phrase laser mic on Google and see how many hits you get. You'll be absolutely amazed.
Okay, the fact that you get a lot of hits means a lot of people think it's a great idea. From any reasonable range, you try to really do it. You get enough signal-to-noise ratio. It's very difficult. Your chances of success are only a couple of percent if things are just right. The amount of motion of that window, the amount of modulation you're going to get, the FM modulation, we're talking about the one of the ways to measure modulation index is in radians. Off that window, the reflection is going to give you microradians and nanoradians of modulation. The signal-to-noise ratio is going to be terrible under normal conditions. So to really do it, you try to go out and buy hardware today that can do that. I don't think you're going to find a vendor that's going to sell you that hardware. I'm not sure that it exists and it will work a high enough percentage of the time that you can sell it to make a profit, if you know what I mean. You've got a lot of hits. Were any of those vendors selling that equipment? The B2LYY, K2LIW?
I didn't go through reading him because I wasn't paying attention to that particular subject. I just, you know how things are on YouTube or whatever, for example. A lot of stuff leads you over there. You can even find on YouTube also put in the term laser mic. You can do that between today and next week and see what information you come up with. Some of it may be baloney and some of it may not be.
Seven and there was a modern toys released in 1969, and that was a simple technology for teeth to make listen to the vibration of the glass by not a laser beam, but light beam. And I was just googling the something, a laser EMAX 350, and they say that it's a Fox News. Okay, this system allows the operator to carry on an undetectable surveillance operation from outside the building. It requires laser transmission, laser receiver, amplifier unit with audio recorder. Enter it here.
Yeah, at one time, theory, you could buy glasses that would allow you to see x-ray through people's clothing and whatever. And there were claims along these lines. The closest thing that ever really existed along these lines was that a CCD camera, which has a strong amount of infrared sensitivity, and an infrared filter in there. If you get a CCD camera where you can remove the infrared filter and set it in the night vision mode, in theory, a wet nylon-based bathing suit becomes somewhat transparent. And you can see through a wet nylon bathing suit with that camera set up that way at high noon. And is there really that much visibility is an interesting question. There's a couple of YouTube videos showing you what you get, and it's not quite as exciting as it sounds, if you know what I mean. So is there really good working equipment that by laser reflection off of the window, you're going to hear the audio in the room in a reliable manner? Can you really do that? I'm a bit skeptical. I'll say it's possible, but the number of times it's going to really work the way you want, it's not going to be anywhere near as high as you like. It's a very difficult thing to make it work just right. You guys probably have some comments on this. KQLIW listening.
I think, just Google EMAX, EMAX, -350. Nice to see device. Explanation how it works. Easy to be done. I have a laser that I just got a few days ago. This one operates in 750 to 840 nanometers, 5 milliwatts, automatic
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Sorry about that. He's mostly skin diet. Enter it here.
Yeah, I heard everything you said by listening to you on the input. How expensive is that thing, and are you going to buy one?
I can make one. I have a laser. And everything is explained. It is explained how to make it, actually. From the information that is there, instead of buying it, and there is an address here, Houston, Texas, is a phone number there. So it's a complete user manual for it. Enter it here.
Are you interested enough to go and build that thing and try it?
No, I have no motivation, to be honest. I could do it for curiosity, but I have so many very much exciting things around me. I have a discussion with Dr. Roy that I'm having about photons right now. And be honest, this is more important for me right now than just playing with the site. It's easy to be done. It's a few minutes. Jump. I mean, all you need is just a binocular and some additional stuff. The laser you can buy anywhere you want, 750 to 840 nanometers, 5 milliwatts, no problem. And the noiseless beam diode, a wavelength of 500 millimeters length, a 9-volt battery, and it says about 15 to 50 hours, depending on the battery power. 10 to 30 milliamps power draw, and to exit, I mean current draw.
I'm going to give one more call to John, who signed in earlier. See if he's come back. Kilo Charlie 2, Sierra Hotel Oscar. Are you there, John? Because you signed in because you had a question. K2LIW in the TechNet. You got it, Eric. Wait for the beeps.
Yeah, real quick question. Did you read that article I sent you about TV viewers?
Sure did, and I've been quoting it to my friends. One of the striking portions of that article is that 50 million people in the United States are today listening to over-the-air television, not using cable or satellite per se. 50 million residents listening to over-the-air television. That's an amazing number to me. I never thought it would be that high. And you were saying that at one time, whoever was then the commissioner of the FCC was talking about eliminating broadcast and just doing everything by cable. I don't think that dog will hunt it, you know what I mean? As I see it, the tradition of broadcast is free-to-air broadcast. I believe will always exist for a long time to come. Is that the essence that you got out of it? You probably got a number of other points out of it, Eric. K2EJ, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, I just wanted to open your eyes a little bit. But one of the important things that they say there, which you'll find to be true throughout most of the rest of the country away from the major metropolitan centers, is that when there's any kind of disaster or weather-related event, the first thing they do is they go to broadcast TV.
Eric, in the last three transmissions, you flipped from transmitter A to transmitter B, and transmitter B is about 8 dB low in audio, so you better turn up that mic gain a little bit. Good sounding transmitter, dead full quieting signal, but the audio is quite low, Eric.
Sorry about that, is this better?
Yeah, I can tell you're shouting into the mic, and that made it a lot better.
Yeah, no, I'm not shouting into the mic. I just put it up near my mouth. I'm using an ATC. I left from where I was and linked up another system so I could continue to listen. But anyway, the point that I was making is that when it comes to natural disasters and things of that nature, when you get away from the big cities, the first thing people do, including tornado warning, is they tune to their local broadcast channel or their local transponder. Whereas there's still people at TV stations, whereas at radio stations they don't even bother to tune into because maybe in Iowa, but the stuff is coming from Chicago. So, localism is one of the big problems.
So, therefore, for safety reasons during an emergency situation, people tune to broadcast to get their information. And 50 million Americans are listening to over-the-air television essentially exclusively. They've decided to stop paying for cable, stop paying for satellite, either economic reasons or pride reasons or whatever. They're living in an area where they get enough channels to keep them happy with over-the-air broadcast. So I think you and I can safely say that over-the-air broadcast is going to exist for at least the rest of our lifetime. I don't think there's any hope of it disappearing, even though we think that we're going to stop broadcasting and do narrowcasting by way of cable. We think that fiber optics, in theory, fiber optics could give us everything we need, but not everybody's hooked up to it. Like you said, there's a hell of a lot of people in rural areas that are not within range of a coaxial cable or a fiber optic cable. KE2EJ, K2LIW, you're going to be broadcasting signal for a long time to come. And I can see that's why you're beefing up your tower. Go ahead, Eric.
K2RIW, K2J. Let's put it this way. The FCC. Pump as many TV stations as possible. And they thought that they were going to sell one heck of a lot of them. But in essence, it turns out they only got about an eighth of what they were planning, so I think it'll be around for a while. K2RIW, K3Z.
Yeah, you're forgetting to speak close to that mic. What brand is that radio? Is that one of these Baofengs that's a super narrow Eric brand?
Negative. This is actually a DLR radio I'm using.
Is there a menu built into that radio where you can set the mic gain? Because you should turn it up 6 dB in my opinion. Because I can hear the fact that in order for you to create enough audio amplitude, you essentially have to eat the mic. Oh, you, Eric. I hope it's got a menu that allows you to adjust mic gain.
K2RIW, K2J.
Back at the house now. I'm on a completely different radio. Actually, there's a separate mic gain. It's set up for DMR, which is actually a bit lower, because of the compression scheme. But there's also a gain for the analog. So I can crank that up a little bit more. K2RIW, K2J.
Yeah, I think you should. I think you should. You've managed to increase the audio by eating the mic, but now what you're doing is you're slamming the speech compressor, the speech clipper. What do we call it now? You know what I mean. Every FM radio transmitter has got something that limits the amount of peak deviation, and you're slamming into that circuit. At the threshold of starting to build square waves. I think it's time we go over to the space report. And some interesting launches took place this week, Paul. And Paul's going to tell us about that. And they finally did, after about 9 attempts, launch that rocket that issued those crazy colors into the atmosphere. WS2N, the space report number 257 of the series. K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
WS2N. Yeah, they got the carrier rocket off the ground and walloped, and I missed it. Because they kept playing it. Because the nine days they tried. They finally got it off on Thursday. And I saw the pictures of what it looked like on the NASA site. I think they had it on a space flight insider. But just see the results. And I'm sure they're happy with it. They had to wait for a very clear night. And they have two science stations that were looking at it. And one down in South Carolina and one up north. And I guess they're going to make some evaluations of what they're looking at. Maybe somewhere down the road we'll get those results. There's a couple of other launches that took off the 23rd and the 25th of last week. SpaceX launched two rockets almost back to back, 2 days apart, and that's a record for them. One from the West Coast, one from the East Coast. And that was very successful. They both took off and put their payloads into orbit. One was a geosynchronous orbit for Bulgaria. And the first stage of that came back and landed successfully on the barge 400 miles out in the Atlantic. And that was flown once before. That was flown on another rocket that was launched out of California. Iridium, they launched 10 Iridium satellites last January, and that rocket had come down, landed in the Pacific Ocean on a barge out there. They shipped it all the way back to Texas, test fired everything in Texas, made sure that it worked, sent it over to Launch Complex 39 and launched it the other day. following that launch, they had a launch out in California. Another Iridium launch sent more of these Iridium satellites, each weighing about 2,000 pounds each. So they got the second bunch off successfully. And again, that ballistic came down and landed on another barge out in the Pacific Ocean, so they'll save that one. So that's, but that was going to reuse one with the Bulgaria satellite and then another one. That's a total of two boosters that have flown before that they flew again. And they plan on doing about five more at least. Reuse first stages. SpaceX coming along, they promised this many years ago, and everything is finally coming along, and in turn, dropping the prices down of the launches. Another launch was supposed to go off tonight, right before the net at 7:30, I watched on the SpaceX webcast, and they get down to 9 seconds. This is Intelsat 35E, they're putting up this geosynchronous orbit. Also launching from Launch Complex 39A in California. And the mission was scrupped due to a GNC, a guidance navigation control computer, shut it down automatically. So they have a little problem, but they believe they can recycle it and get it ready for tomorrow, probably around the 7th, around the same time as the time it's going to be 7. 7:37 p.m. is the time when that goes off, so you can look at that on a SpaceX website, and that's an interesting mission. It's not one of the ones that are going to be coming back and landing on a drone ship because the satellite is so heavy. They've done away with the landing legs on the first stage, they've done away with the fins on the first stage as well. The grid fins that guide the satellite back to a landing. They scrapped all of that, and that's why they use all the power, minimum amount of weight to get this big satellite to geosynchronous orbit for Intelsat. Talking about the grid fins, the last flight they did change the design or the material that they use for the grid fins. The past flights that have come back, about 12 of them now that have landed successfully, they use these aluminum-made grid fins, and they're getting real charred as they come back through the atmosphere. So SpaceX changed over. This is one last flight that they had rebuilt different material. Instead of the aluminum, they used titanium. They need to do that because they need to refly these things over and over again. So that was pretty interesting to see the design. Every time they launch another rocket, they always improve on these boosters, second stage. They were very active. So, being a self-funded company, you know, you can make those quick adjustments. Turned out to be a very good, successful company. And now competing against United Launch Alliance to launch government flights. And they've already won a flight for that. So, who knows? Bring the cost down, next thing you know, they'll be able to move on to their next major change, which would be changing the whole rocket, something called the ITS, Interplanetary Transportation System, and that's the next goal, but that's some years away, and that would be the same type of deal, be able to launch, first stage would be able to return. From the back to the launch complex. But of course, that would be a much bigger booster. So much for SpaceX. There's other things that are going on. NASA has worked on an airplane that is a supersonic airplane. They've got the design to the point where they are putting models through wind tunnels, and I've done successfully at the end of last month. And they think by 2022 or so, they should have a prototype ready to fly. The supersonic transport that, instead of being only allowed to fly over the water, it will be allowed to fly over land. It's designed apparently in such a way to eliminate the sonic boom. So I don't have any stats on how fast it would be able to go, but I do have a picture of the prototype. So it's a very dark looking thing. NASA does that type of work very well. Everybody thinks they just concentrate on the space program. But NASA really stands for National Aeronautics and Space Administration. So that aeronautics part is still a big part of it, of NASA. A couple other things, but maybe we'll stop for now. See if anybody has comments. That's okay too. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet.
As you're about to find out, you already know it, but maybe other people listening are going to find out that I've got a fair amount of skepticism about the economic viability of a supersonic transport. In the case of the Concorde supersonic transport, it was really heavily being subsidized by the European government to back that project. And even with all of that subsidy, the person buying the ticket to fly supersonically from New York to London or New York to Paris, he paid a very big price. And the very big price got him there a couple of hours earlier. Is your time that valuable? Are you worth $1,000 an hour, if you know what I mean, in real cost? Because to fly an aircraft supersonically, you study what Kelly Johnson had to do to make that SR-71 fly at a few times the speed of sound when it dropped. He had to do heroic things from an aeronautical engineer's point of view, make sure that the surfaces of the aircraft could tolerate temperatures, to make sure the aircraft, air conditioning was powerful enough so you're not cooking the human beings in a 400 degree oven, special fuels, special lubricants, special tires, everything is expensive, and your miles per gallon. In the case of the SR-71, the miles per gallon were very good when it flew at 85,000 feet. Well, you don't do that with a passenger transport aircraft. The supersonic transport, you've got the problem of the shockwave is capable of breaking people's windows, and even if you design the aircraft to be aerodynamically very, very clean, you're going to take that shockwave and cut it down by 6 dB, but it's still a powerful noise, and it's a powerful, expensive aircraft to run from a passenger transport point of view. So I'm very skeptical that anybody's going to rebuild a supersonic transport. I'll admit that doing it with 2020 technology, you can do it a lot better than the Concorde. But still, you're going to have to do heroic engineering things to make it work. And are there enough people willing to pay that much money just to get there an hour or two earlier when they drop them? I'm going to combine this into two very difficult questions for you, Paul. I gave you question number one. And question number two, of all of these guys building pretty nice spacecraft these days, are any of them still talking about colonizing the moon colonizing Mars. And there, in both cases, the degree of difficulty to put somebody on the moon for more than 3 days, to put somebody on Mars for a fraction of a year, the risks involved, the engineering involved, the degree of difficulty involved is such that it really is my belief that with our lifetime, within the lifetimes of the people that are listening to our voices, I don't think it's going to happen. I could be wrong, but I could give you a whole long list of reasons of why you don't get your money's worth, if you know what I mean. It's going to take multinational, huge amounts of investment of multiple nations in order to be able to pull it off economically. And each of those nations are going to say, if I spend 10% of my gross national product of me and 10 or 15 other nations in order to make this work, and there's only a 50-50 chance that the astronauts are going to get to Mars alive, and only a 25% chance they're going to come back home 3 years later and still be alive, and what are we getting in return for this huge investment in human beings and dollars, so to speak? For those reasons, I just don't think it's going to take place. But are there people still talking about doing it? To send a spacecraft there that's capable of taking an unmanned vehicle? Absolutely. But a manned vehicle? Wow. And to WS2N, can you defend that project there, Paul? If you were heading it for
repeater, time out.
If you were heading that project, Paul, would you be able to sell it, do you think? WS2N? Thank you, LIW. You're a good salesman. Do you think you could sell that one?
Oh, I would be pushing for it, but I'm a terrible salesman. They wouldn't put me up there to try to sell their product. I'd like to work on the product, but I don't think I'd sell it to anybody. The SST, Supersonic Transport, I remember seeing this walking through the 1964 World's Fair, an American version. And then it was all dropped. I mean, they would put money towards this thing. And they basically came up with a cost factor over time. What it would cost not only to build it, but to operate it. So they scrapped that. But they had a beautiful model of what this thing was going to look like as you were walking through one of the pavilions. Of course, Concorde came up with it. I was surprised to see British and French got together and put this thing together, and the Americans had nothing. But it was pretty sharp. I mean, in 1976, I remember seeing the first couple ones flying over New York, flying from London to go to Kennedy, and the others also down to Washington, D.C. We were driving around at the right time in the morning, going to work. You looked up. Almost at the same time every morning you would see the SST or the Concorde. But I think they only had 100 or so seats, very expensive to run. All those problems NASA thinks they're able to lift here. In fact, the supersonic transport that NASA's developing, they actually call it Quest. QUESST. So, they think that, this Q stands for quiet. So, the quiet supersonic transport. And they know that the boom won't be a boom. It would be more like a thud. You're not going to even notice it as you go from one coast to the other. And they've already, they've done computer modeling and now they're testing it in wind tunnels, and now they want to build a prototype. So where it goes from there, of course, things eventually wind up going from NASA to private corporations to build these things. Years ago, Pan Am would fly these things, or now today, who knows, maybe Delta or one or the other airliners. Or the international airline is might buy into it. So, you know, if it's any good, somebody will buy it. There's always going to be people that can afford this. The engine, looks like there's one big engine on top of the back wing. So maybe that's how, maybe that's one of the ways that they think they're going to keep it quiet. You know, if you look at the concourse, the engines were, you know, naturally under the wing. Things above the back wing, with the intake above the fuselage. I don't see any other engines on it. So, we'll see how that goes. As far as putting people on Mars and the moon, there's many companies still talking about it. Blue Origin is developing a lander that they're calling it a Blue drop it. I think it's Blue Moon. Landers will supply anybody that goes there. If it's not the United States, it'll be somebody else. Japan now is looking to develop a landing program for their own astronauts in 2030 timeframe for the moon. But to get there, first step is to get to the space station that's not built yet. It's called the Gateway Space Station, that's going to be put in orbit around the moon, most likely by the United States and Russia and European Space Agency. Collectively, we'll probably put this Gateway Space Station in orbit. And Japan wants to use that as a stop-off point before they take their own developed lander equipment down to the moon. They want to go down to the South Pole and stay there. So that's the 2030 for Japan. Russia's thinking about the same type of thing. I don't know what's about there. Time frame, it keeps changing. Years ago it was 2024, and I heard 2028, probably 2030, probably 2032. For Russia, they plan on doing something similar. The United States government, as far as I know, has no plans on landing there. But they plan on being a big, you know, being really involved with the Gateway Space Station around the moon. From there, then they think they could eventually, as the years go on, probably 2030 plus, send one of these habitats that are going around the moon, separate from that station, and actually go off to Mars. So that's the United States plan for man landing on Mars. Now, Elon Musk is a little different. I don't think he has any plans of going to the moon first. He wants to go direct with the ITS system. WS2N, the Interplanetary Transport System. Used to call the, he had a different name for it. Mars Colonial Transport. Now he's changed it to ITS, and this thing, this is big, if not bigger than a Saturn V rocket when it would take off. The first complete stage would come back, refuel a number of times. The second stage would stay in orbit around the Earth two or three times of refueling this initial second stage that's now flying around up in orbit around Earth. Will eventually deorbit Earth and go off to Mars. Infrastructure, he's not big on. He pretty much said in a speech I heard once, saying, you know, he's like the guy that's building the ship to get across the ocean, you know, when they came to America. You know, he'll build the ships to get here. But, you know, he thinks probably up to other people to develop the infrastructure to stay on Mars. And I think that's a bigger problem. It's not bigger than actually flying to Mars. So I think we're going to have this work cut out of, you know, trying to convince other countries or other companies to make that kind of a... Stand by one. That should be a little bit better. Got to put my fan on. And back to you, Dick. That's pretty much all I got on that. There's a lot of companies and countries, including India. India wants to make a moonshot to probably 2035, something like that. They're developing a manned space program. They've got a capsule that they've developed. So everybody's got their foot in the water, but nobody's there yet.
In the case of the Apollo program, when we went to the moon, no one had ever touched lunar soil before. We didn't know if it was going to be blue cheese, a mile thick pumice dust. They didn't know what it was going to be like. So for scientific reasons, you wanted to know what the soil was like. The moon is a pristine thing that hasn't been eroded by weather like the Earth does, so you find out a little bit more about what the original material that made up the solar system. There's a bunch of scientific reasons to go to the moon a few times, but our major motivation was to prove that we had the technology to climb back up to being close to number one with reference to spacecraft. The Sputnik really flawed us when they launched a satellite in orbit around the Earth a couple of years before we were capable of doing it, and we tried to do a catch-up for the next decade and a half, and we eventually did. So, to show what we could do compared to the Russians and to do some early science, there was reasonably good motivation to go to the moon. Then, of all these guys that think they're going to go back to the moon now, what do they think they're going to get in return? Let me drop it. I don't care if the moon contained gold, platinum, uranium, plutonium, thorium, neptunium. I don't care what it contains. If you think you're going to go there and discover that valuable stuff, mine it, and bring it back to the Earth, when you go to the economics of leaving this very deep gravity well called Earth, climbing over that hill, going down into the gravity well of the moon, finding this stuff, packing it into your ship, climbing back out of the moon's gravity well, over the hill, back down into the Earth's gravity well, when you look at the physics of all of the thrusting of fuel, of chemical fuels required, the cost per pound of getting your spacecraft there and getting it back, you can't name a substance on the moon that could be possibly valuable enough to make that economically viable. So if you're saying that you're going to set up the world's best radio telescope or optical telescope on the moon, I can sort of see that. But beyond that, those who think they want to go to the moon, other than saying that they can do it, does anybody talk about what the benefit of being there is going to be? I know that's a tough one, Paul. WS2N, KQRIW. I don't make these questions easy for you, Paul. Go ahead.
Well, all of the above as far as Jeff Bezos with Amazon. .com. He's the owner of Amazon. He owns, I think, the fourth or fifth richest guy in the world. He owns Blue Origin, and he's planning on developing ships to land there and come back. He's talking about cargo ships. So I guess he's thinking about bringing moon stuff back eventually. They think they could take the minerals on the moon and eventually convert it on the moon to other uses. There's aluminum there, and you've actually built things using 3D printing. So, you know, that whole system is being developed slowly but surely. And there's a lot of private companies involved in that kind of research. And also, there's many people, rich people, that are willing to go there to visit. Okay, you know, to actually start to set up hotels. Bigelow from Bigelow Industries built these inflatable modules. Got one attached to the International Space Station now, which people can go in successfully attached for over a year now. It's going to stay attached for another year, testing it. I mean, you know, you might have a situation where people will pay to go on a trip in Bigelow's hotel. I mean, that's how Bigelow got rich. He had a, I think it was Motel 6. He'll continue that.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
No spot on the moon. Yeah, I'm all for that, but that's pretty much it. All the countries are going to want to be able to say that they have a base on the moon someday. Back to
you. And you can always properly advertise your hotel on the moon and make it sound desirable. And a certain number of rich people are going to sign up to go to your hotel on the moon. What in the world are they going to do when they get there? When you and I go on vacation on the Earth, you go to some exotic place, you got a fancy looking hotel, you got a golf course, you got a swimming pool, you got a beachfront, you can walk around, you can look at the forest, you can look at the hills, you can look at the waterfalls, a whole lot of things you and I can do in a nice hotel with plush looking rooms and five star food and whatever. You've got none of that on the moon. During the day on the moon, it goes to 150 degrees centigrade, way beyond life-threatening temperature and hot. At nighttime, it goes to minus 200 and some odd degrees centigrade, way beyond life-threatening of cold. The amount of heating and air conditioning you need is going to be huge. You go to the North Pole or the South Pole of the moon, you don't have those temperature extremes. You have extremely cold temperature, essentially all the time. And you think that the people are going to travel around on the moon? Are they going to put on spacesuits? I mean, the design that goes into that very specific spacesuit that fits your particular body. As an astronaut, let me drop each of your astronauts are carefully chosen, very healthy people of a very specific size. You take American tourists. Boy, they come all kinds of big and small and fat and skinny and crazy shaped. You're going to design a spacesuit for all of those people. And they're going to have the danger of, there's a zillion ways that a minor error in a spacesuit can kill you. The waste product control in the spacesuit is very complicated, not pleasant. You have to wear a diaper. So you're not going to have enough spacesuits of the right size to let very many people go outside. Therefore, they're going to just stay inside. Therefore, they're going to be sardines in a can. There's not much to look at out there through the window. To travel around in it, to jump up and down in 1/6 gravity, that would be kind of fun. But you have to wear a spacesuit to do that. You're going to spend 99% of your time in the hotel, so to speak. You're a sardine in a can. And outside is a very hostile environment, temperature-wise, air pressure-wise, solar radiation-wise. No atmosphere to protect you from meteorites, solar wind, cosmic rays. It's not a pleasant place to go. It sounds exciting on paper until you get into the specifics. going to have enough people signing up with enough money to run your corporation that's creating this quasi-colony on the moon. Do you believe there's a solution to all of those problems, Paul? I know that with modern technology you can hack away and make a lot of them twice as easy as they are now. But twice as easy is something that's that hard.
Repeater, timeout.
As I was saying, that's not enough. So, with all these proposals, I don't think they get into any of the specifics, do they? Well, they only talk about the glamorous portion of it, of spending your vacation on the moon. WS2N, KQIW, and maybe somebody wants to join us to drag your feet a little bit. KQIW, listening.
KQIS, query.
Go ahead, Bill. Wait, make sure you wait for the beep.
Yeah, hearing a single beep on this end. So, this is not really related to the practicality of going to Mars or the Moon, but I'm wondering what it takes. You know, the space shuttle is a space plane. It's in, it only goes to a low Earth orbit. There's a lot of engineering involved, you know, for heat-resistant tiles in order to be able to make the descent down to the planet. I'm wondering if you have something that's very light, that's in a decaying orbit, say it's a block of styrofoam, and you want it to be able to
K2UPF.
What would you how difficult is that problem by itself? How much engineering would that take? AC2IS.
Yeah, Rich, K2UPF recognized. If you literally took a block of styrofoam, put it in orbit, it has a very low mass to area ratio. It's got very little beef to it. Therefore, only a minor amount of wind resistance is going to slow it down in a hurry. Would that chunk of foam survive re-entry into the Earth without burning up? I think the answer is absolutely yes. A chunk of foam. You can't build a spacecraft out of foam. You have to make the spacecraft strong enough to survive 15 pounds per square inch of air pressure in some finite amount of volume that takes human beings. It's a very strong skin of some kind of material. It's got to have rocket motors. It's got to have life support systems. It's got to have all kinds of stuff that's heavy. Once you make that spacecraft heavy, and you're moving it at 17,500 miles an hour to be in the lowest Earth orbit you can put it in. Let me drop it. A heavy object moving 17,500 miles an hour has a huge amount of kinetic energy. To bring that object back through the atmosphere, you have to dispel all of that kinetic energy. You have to bring that 17,500 miles an hour down to something like a couple of meters per second before you hit the surface of the Earth. Every bit of that kinetic energy has to be dissipated. When you dissipate that many joules of energy, you're creating temperatures like 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit on the surface. You have to protect from that. Not easy. So, you can't land a foam aircraft with human beings on board. It's my first, thing to worry about in your question. I hate being sounding so negative, but you gotta know where the minefield is before you take this trip, if you know what I mean. Otherwise, you're gonna get yourself into an awful lot of trouble. But maybe Rich has got a solution. K2 Uncle Papa Sierra. Mobile. Oh, wait a minute now. This is the 4th of July. You might still be on vacation. Go ahead, Rich. K2UPS, K2LIW.
K2UPS Mobile. Good evening, Big. No, I'm not on vacation. I am working. And I am eastbound on the Pennsylvania Turnpike right now. We have a lovely town of Man's Choice, PA. That mile off to 130. Yes, what would somebody do when they go to the moon to pass the time and stuff? I'd be happy to climb. I'd bring one of my QRP radios and go outside
as long as I could operate a key with the gloves on. Obviously, I'm just guessing, but that could be interesting. Back to your dick.
Yeah, it turns out that the a very well-equipped ground station on the Earth could, in theory, be able to hear your handy-talky on the moon. And you could hold conversations with that guy. Handy-talky, Earth to moon, not a chance. The best range anyone has ever gotten on a handy-talky is Owen Garriott, space shuttle number 6, I think it was, when he's over northern Texas, was within line of sight of Long Island, and over that 1,500-mile range, real line of sight, handy-talky could talk to handy-talky. 1,500 miles is about the maximum. Earth is a quarter of a million miles away. My inverse square law, you're 40 dB too weak in signal strength. NASA talked back to the Earth from the moon by using a good-sized parabolic dish at Goldstone, 240 feet in diameter, if you know what I mean. It takes some pretty serious hardware to talk across a quarter of a million miles with radio. So even if, let me drop it. Even if the glove on your spacesuit has enough flexibility that gives you the dexterity that you can operate to push the talk switch on your handy-talky, are you going to be able to go out there? And by the way, the handy-talky is going to be on the outside of the spacesuit, and you're on the inside. How do you talk to the microphone on your handy-talky in that situation? Maybe you've got a solution to that one. I guess if you've got a microphone inside of your spacesuit, and you've got a connector on the outside of the spacesuit, and you put this umbilical cord between the connector on the outside of the spacesuit, and you bring the umbilical cord over to your handy-talky. So that can get you audio to the handy-talky. A very well-designed glove allows you to push-the-talk switch, and now you're radiating a couple of watts into the rubber duck. And the signal being received on Earth, other than the Goldstone dish, nobody on Earth is going to be able to talk to you. So that part is going to be difficult, as I see it, Rich. KTUPS in what was that again? Man's Desire or something like the name of the town? An exciting sounding name. I'm afraid to ask what goes on there. KTUPS, KQLAW.
There's a push to talk button on the inside of it as well. It was man's joystick, yes, and there's a lot of very strange sounding paths here in PA. But you misunderstood. I would not be using an HP. I would be on HF for the QRP radio, and you know me on HF. I do not use voice. It's only CW, so that's not a problem. But I knew that would be a long shot, but that way it would keep me busy anyway. So back to you, Vic.
A QRP on the Earth with a favorable ionospheric reflection, we call it, but it's really refraction, allows you to talk almost around the world. And from this side of the Earth to the other side of the Earth is 12,000 miles. That's a long way different from a quarter of a million miles one way, Earth to Moon. Can your QRP rig do that? I think the answer is no. A kilowatt on HF on Earth, the ionosphere is not going to stop you. How big an antenna do you have to have on the moon to be able to hear that CW signal? You and I can do that calculation, and yes, that is doable. Closing CW to the moon is definitely doable. Obviously, the fact that moon maps have been done. It's really two ways, if you know what I mean. So, HF to the moon is quite doable. And, please QSL, I've now worked the moon. You're going to work all counties or all grid squares on the moon. Is there going to be an award for all grid squares on the moon, Rich? KTUPS, KQLAW?
Maybe they could have it like a DXDC for contacting all the craters.
WF2X.